In a world where there is a scourge across the land, taking the very life breath of the people. A world rife with snorers. One man and one show stand tall in the battle against sleep apnea. That man is Richard Webb. That show is the CPAP Sleep Specialist Show. And the time is now.
Good morning, and wake up, America. Wake up to the CPAP Sleep Specialist Show. This is your host, Richard Webb, and in studio this morning is my guest, Dr. Thomas Speer. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good to be here with you again.
Good morning. We're all rooting for the Texans today. We were disappointed in Tebow Mania last night. Too bad for the Broncos, but we're really rooting for the Houston Texans this morning. So if you're out there and you'd like to give us a call questioning about your sleep disorders or what you should do about your obstructive sleep apnea or you're having a problem with your CPAP, give us a call, 713-439-1560. And you can email us your questions, and we'll try to get back to you off air to the CPAP show at monitormedical.com. Or visit the Monitor Medical website, and there's a click link that you can go into and ask your questions online like that. So without further ado, Dr. Speer, you're boarded by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. What is the American Academy of Sleep Medicine? What is its function?
It's predominantly a professional organization that helps physicians and clinicians from the whole breadth of sleep medicine to maintain standards. Standards for how to practice,
okay,
how to do a sleep study, how one deals with different diagnostic groups other than just obstructive sleep apnea, how they might treat restless legs or periodic limb movements or things of that sort. So it's a self-monitored, if you will, organization that sets standards. And if you're interested in becoming part of that professional organization, you apply and agree to follow these practice policies, and really that then distinguishes you from those who do not. And one of the things that we have found in any new field, or really any field, that when there's a lot of people do it, they do it in different ways. And this is, you know, that if you get a test done by an accredited facility in Texas, it's done the same way whether you're in New York or whether you are in Montana.
So is every sleep lab an accredited by American Academy of Sleep Medicine?
No. I'd say there's somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 centers in the United States that are accredited, and probably twice that many that are facilities. There's other organizations that do accreditation, but they are not focused on the science of sleep medicine as the American Academy of Sleep Medicine is. So not everyone's accredited. Many of them are accredited by the other bodies like the Joint Commission and a couple others that provide insurance companies and governmental agencies some sort of assessment as to whether they have standards in which they protect the patient, protect the technologists, and allow the test to be done consistently.
So you've done sleep medicine a long time, and you have been in the American Academy for a long time. Now, you go in, and in fact, part of your extra function is to go in and inspect some of these sleep labs, and you go in and you basically make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing and everybody's not hiding skeletons in the closet.
That's correct. What they have to do, it's a fairly lengthy process for them for reasons, just it takes a long time to pull together everything you do, write it down as a policy, educate your professional staff as well as your technical staff, make sure that they have the credentials necessary, and you fill out a long application that is reviewed, and then once it's reviewed, it's then passed on to the site visitor, who then reviews all that material and then pays a visit. And during that visit, you go through and see if each one of the standards, as they've been written by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, are being followed. And if they're not, then they have a chance to correct it, and then they eventually can get recognized as a member center of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which is a fairly difficult process to go through because everything you can think of has to be followed by a certain standard, and that standard has to be consistent with what's written in the literature, and the professional staff or the doctors have to be able to articulate why they do what they do. And basically the site survey is you go in and say, this is what you said in your policy, you're going to do, show me how you do it and make sure you are consistent with that. And that's oftentimes, it's, you know, write down what you're going to do and do what you say you're going
to
do.
You know, if I'm getting a sleep study and I'm going into a sleep lab, I think it's important to ask question one, are you an accredited sleep lab?
Correct.
You know, some of the insurance companies, I don't believe they might not approve payment for your sleep test if it's not an accredited sleep lab.
That is true, and it varies from state to state. Some states, for many years, have required that their sleep facilities be accredited, and many of them focus just on the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Texas has just moved into that for any governmental reimbursed program. Private insurers are doing that as well. And the reason they're trying to do that is because it is a substantiation to the insurance company and to the public or the patient that they are doing the test according to some set of guidelines.
Hmm. So how long have you been seeing sleep patients? I know I've known you a long time, but without embarrassing you,
25 years.
Sleep medicine obviously has changed. Some of it is not. Some of it has changed. What things have you seen changed to sleep disorders and sleep treatment over the last 25 years?
I think it comes down to two areas. And one is that we know so much more now than we did 25 years ago about what's going on at night with sleep, what is the patient's presentation, in other words, what are their symptoms, the signs that give us an indicator that they have a sleep problem, and then what in that information gathering and knowledge that we now have, we now know it's so closely tied to so many other medical problems like high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke, heart problems, obesity, all are interrelated, and as I tend to like to say, that we're rubbing shoulders with all these other medical problems. And unless you improve one's quality of sleep, it's very difficult for the physician to treat the other problems because the sleep is so disruptive. The other area, other than more knowledge, is the technology. When I say technology, not only the technology we use to assess the test itself is now computerized. Our sensors are better. Our comprehensiveness has improved because of our gathering of information by computers. We used to do this, a lot of things, by just an old polygraph like you see on, you know, a lie detector. And we just had maybe 14 different parameters that we look at. It was on paper, and we had to turn the paper. And somebody had to go and count everything. And it was very laborious. You didn't redo things very often. Now we can massage the data, if you will, over and over again to see what we can find out. But in the area of sleep disordered breathing or obstructive sleep apnea, our devices are so much more sophisticated, quieter, more effective, data collecting. The mask interfaces are so much different than they were 25 years ago. So I would say that we know more. We don't know it everything. For sure.
You know, it's sort of like in medicine, as things become uncovered and you start examining things closer, you didn't realize that all those things were going on. I don't think that I remember treating patients in the early 80s, and I don't recall the doctors worrying about hypertension, diabetes. They were worried that the guy was going to fall asleep at the wheel and crash and kill somebody, and the doctor was going to be liable for not taking care of that person.
Yeah, sleepiness was The first one, because they were being misdiagnosed. Another sleepy diagnosis is narcolepsy. Mm-hmm. And narcolepsy and sleep apnea are very, very different disorders.
Although you can have them both, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's learning to differentiate between all those and then apply the appropriate treatment. Even though positive airway pressure is the first line of treatment for any sleep disordered breathing, there's a lot of ways to apply that. There's a lot of other things that you have to improve, like sleeping regular hours and making sure your sleep environment is conducive to sleep and that you don't eat a heavy meal before you go to bed at night. That you don't drink too much caffeine or you don't exercise or use too much alcohol. All those things affect how well any treatment modality, whether it be pharmacological treatment like sleep medications or medications that reduce leg movements or anything.
Remember when people used to find out that they couldn't sleep because they had sleep apnea, so their doctor would give them a heavy sedation, a sleep pill, to so knock them out that they...
Yeah.
They were worse, you know.
They were.
The basic thought was, if you can't sleep because you're waking up and choking, I'm going to give you a sleeping pill, and now you'll be so zonked that you'll stop breathing, and hopefully you'll wake up in the morning altogether.
Hopefully. Because if you think about it, the multiple arousals or the awakenings that are associated with sleep disruption and sleep disordered breathing is your safety mechanism. That's what keeps you alive.
We're here on the CPAP Sleep Specialist Show. My guest this morning is Dr. Thomas Spearn, ordered by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. We'll be back after this brief intermission, taking your calls, 713-439-1560. Back to the CPAP Sleep Special Show. Trying to talk this morning. Wake up, America. And we have a caller this morning who has a question about their CPAP. Good morning.
Good morning.
How can I help you?
I've got sleep apnea. I don't use my CPAP like I'm supposed to. But the main reason is because I feel claustrophobic when it's on me.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it just feels like I'm gasping for air sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the pressure's up and everything. It's supposedly set to the right thing, but I feel claustrophobic with it on.
Do you know what your pressure is offhand, what your prescribed pressure is?
Not right offhand. I really need to go get another test. It's been a while since I've been tested. I had my adenoids removed and all my tonsils and all that good stuff. It helped out, but...
Right.
Yeah. But, it's definitely my sleep apnea. It seems like it's getting worse. I'm dozing off, driving more and more these days.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, when you feel that phobic or anxious response, is there any sensation that you're most aware of?
No, when I do it, I usually yank it off my head. So, very seldom do I get to sleep through the night with it on. I just feel that claustrophobic feeling.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not claustrophobic in any other sense of the way, but just with that, I am. Feels like I'm just not getting the air.
Yeah, you're almost air starved, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. It may be a pressure issue,
okay.
Which is where you're going. There is also masks now that have very little presence on your face. They're what we call nasal pillows that just go into your nostrils and have a very limited headgear.
Okay.
You may look at that, and a lot of people that have that problem find that helps reduce that. The other thing is, if you feel like you're not getting enough air or it's too dry, those two things, just by adding, make sure you have adequate humidification and you get enough pressure, may relieve that. But the other thing is again, you're not thinking about it being anxious provoking. You just sense it and immediately respond by taking it off. You can practice during the day and just with you holding it, practice breathing on it. And then each day or you add it a little bit of time and progressively get used to wearing it longer and longer. Now, this is during wake, but the point is you get more accustomed to the sensation of the mask or the interface on your face and the amount of pressure and humidity and build, an hour every day. And if it takes you another 3 to 4 weeks or even a longer to get accustomed to it, that progressive process may relieve you of that discomfort that you sense in the middle of the night. But my hunch is that you need to have your pressure reassessed, as well as maybe look at different mask interfaces.
Okay. Well, it's been probably 7 years since I've gotten a test. Is there a certain amount of time you probably should get tested when you sleep apnea?
And you're beyond that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I'd say usually we've said anywhere from a year, but which is a little aggressive, to 2 to 3 years. Definitely within 5 years you should get it repeated.
So, yeah, I'll definitely set up an appointment and go get tested again.
Let me say one thing. And so often what we do in this treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, it's a trial and error kind of thing. And I think Dr. Spear's question about the feelings and what problems that you have occurring, some people have an anxiety towards a piece of something in their face. And if you can wear a baseball cap and sunglasses and, you know, it doesn't bother you, that's probably not the case, because the air pressure blowing in you almost feels like you're suffocating.
Mm-hmm.
And if the type of mask that you had initially was one that just covered your nose.
Exactly.
Believe it or not, what we call a full face mask that covers the nose and the mouth, it actually seems to reduce that occurrence of the feeling of the inability to breathe, because when you're having the air pressure in your nose, there's so much pressure. And if you have it on your nose and mouth, then it equalizes the pressure, sort of like being in a plane. You know, you're at a higher pressure, you're at a lower pressure, but it's all-encompassing, it's ambient. And so you may find that a mask that covers the nose and the mouth might help too. And these are some of these things that you have to try. Mm-hmm. Trial and error, and there are a lot of techniques that we've used in the past. Dr. Spear mentioned one about trying it, putting the mask up to your face and holding it for a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And it is a comfort issue. And one of the things we have a part of our desensitization process is to get the doctor to give us a prescription to lower the pressure to sort of let you build up to it. And
okay.
For the first, say, let's just pick an arbitrary number. Say you had a pressure of 15 centimeters. We might say, well, I can handle 7.5. So we'll start you at 7.5 and say, come back in a week. And we'll try to increase it to 8.5 or 9, you know.
Okay.
And because it is, it's not normal to breathe with your head stuck out the window going 60 miles an hour. You know, it
yep.
just doesn't feel right, does it?
Nope. All right, well, thank you very much.
Persistence pays off, my friend. That was an interesting question that people often have about not being able to tolerate their positive air pressure device, Dr. Spear. And, you know, there's a lot of modalities that we can try, certainly a lot more than there were 25 years ago. And I remember when we used to set up a patient 25 years ago, we didn't even write down what mask they had, because there was really only one company that sold masks. And we said medium mask, and you got what you got. And that was all there was. But there are so many alternatives. There are literally hundreds of types of masks. And these different types of products are really designed to make it comfortable to you. Whenever I give a talk in front of a group of people, I always tell them to listen up, because I'm going to tell them the best masks that they can possibly get. And everybody gets quiet. And I just say, the best mask is the one that works for you. And then they all let out this, how disappointing, because it really is true, because something might work for one guy and their twin brother, it doesn't work at all.
Right. And masks change your comfort or your ability to enjoy or feel pleasant with a mask can change over time. Maybe 2 or 3 years with one type of mask, and then that's it. It doesn't work anymore. But an interesting point, most of the time when you find, if you will, the sweet spot with pressure, humidity, and mask, and right time in bed, people say they don't even know there's air, that they will – the machines are so quiet they can't hear them. And the only thing they can hear is sometimes a slight leak around when they're getting started. And even if that's not there, which isn't a lot of the times now, is they move their hand in front of the mask where there's an exhalation port or a area where the air is flowing out of the mask to keep things fresh inside the mask itself, and they have to feel the air. So my point is that once we succeed, people don't even know that the machine's working and there is pressure. And that's what one's goal ought to be. The kind of difficulty that the caller had is one that needs to be worked on very diligent and persistently at first to get to the other end of it.
You know, the different types of masks, we probably, two-thirds of the masks we put out today are the kind that are direct nasal pillow seal type mask, and it's because they're so much lighter and smaller. But there are those people out there who just cannot tolerate anything at the tip of their nose, and they have to have the air blowing on the top of their nose as opposed to at the inside of their nares, the opening that goes into the nose. I know this sounds pretty strange, so if you're just turning into the radio station to hear about air blowing up your nose, but we're here talking about sleep disorders and CPAP and problems of obstructive sleep apnea and how you're going to treat it. Our guest today is Dr. Thomas Spear. We're talking about all these issues. So, Dr. Spear, say you're somebody and you're married to a person who you know has a bad problem, and they're choking and snoring, and you hit them into the ribs, and you finally start sleeping in the other room because you're having spousal induced insomnia because they're choking and rattling is just keeping you up at night. So how does a person like that convince their spouse to get tested to document that they have a sleep disorder? What have you done in the past to get people to come out of the closet, so to speak?
Well, I guess it's to offer them some sort of expectancy. Why would I want to do this? Will my life be any different? I don't want to wear something just for no apparent reason. And I think the first thing is that daytime functioning, alertness, activity levels, memory, sexual function, to name a few, will improve. We oftentimes push that the medical consequences of obstructive sleep apnea are life-threatening. And people say, well, that's good to know. My spouse is going to push harder. But what is it going to do for me tonight and tomorrow? Well, it will improve your functioning. It will make you feel better, and the quality of your life will definitely improve. And then you add the other, it'll add longevity. So we can improve the quality of your life, and we can assure you that you live longer.
A term that gets tossed around a lot is, I couldn't tolerate my CPAP. And we hear about people in family members, and we see it all the time at work. But what does that mean when your doctor says or the person tells the people, I couldn't tolerate it? What does that mean to you?
It means that they decided not to wear it.
That's a good simple. they just refused to put it on. There are all kinds of sleep labs, and we were talking about accreditation at the top of the show, talking about different types of accrediting bodies. American Academy of Sleep Medicine is one of the oldest and most recognized names. But there are sleep labs that test patients in their homes. There are patients testing facilities that test the patients in the lab. And there are all kinds of equipment that can be done and used for both of these type of tests. And we're coming up on a break here, but just briefly give us a primer about what a home sleep test is, if somebody's interested.
A home sleep test is a reduced amount of sensors, if you will, looking at just how you're breathing and your oxygen level at night. And it's easy to put on. You wear it when you're sleeping and drop it off or send it in the mail to the doctor the next day.
Well, you're listening to the CPAP show here on 1560 The Game. Give us a call, 713-439-1560. Our guest today is Dr. Thomas Spear. And when we come back after this break, we're going to talk a little bit more about home sleep testing. We'll be back. Show. Welcome back. Wake Up America. This is your host, Richard Webb, and we're talking about sleep disorders. Give us a call, 713-439-1560, or email us your questions to the CPAP show at monitormedical.com. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Spear, and we're discussing about sleep disorder problems and his many, many years of experience. And when we went to the last break, Dr. Spear, we were talking about CPAP desensitization. We were talking about a little bit about home sleep testing. And during the break, I had mentioned to you, you know, there's a lot of people out there, like the caller that had just called in earlier. There's a lot of people out there that have a CPAP machine in their closet, and they just won't wear it. And they've had it for a year or 5 years, and they recognize that their problems have not gone away. If anything, they've gotten worse. Their sleep disorder problems, they're increasing their high blood pressure medications, they're falling asleep at the traffic lights, and they think, you know, I need to get back in this. So what's a fella to do? What's the direct approach to take with these people?
I think the first is, as you mentioned, you want to get back in the game. You want to give it another shot. And again, give it another open-minded approach. The discomfort that you had don't necessarily mean that they will persist. What will persist, you still have the disorder. You still have pauses in breathing while you're asleep, which is going to make your health somewhat in jeopardy. I guess the first thing is to make sure that, you know, get it out of the closet, it's functioning, and that the mask is, you know, still in decent shape. And I think, you know, the three parts of getting comfortable is making sure that mask is still fitting well and it serves its purpose. I think another thing is, as we talked with a call earlier in the show, that pressure is does the job. And I think we know that pressure changes, and if you've lost or gained weight or changed medications, the need to reassess that pressure. That's why the auto titrating devices have become more interesting to us. And then the other thing is that I think which we've talked on the show is humidification. If you don't have adequate humidification and your nose clogs up and your mouth gets dry, you can't tolerate it. In other words, that those discomforts makes it very difficult. So make sure you get enough humidification. And simple thing there is there's usually a heated humidifier. Crank up that number from the 2 or 3 that you probably had it set on and go to 4 or 5 and practice with it and see how well you do. Now, any amount of pressure will help. Too much makes it harder to wear it longer. Too little, the same thing. So the issue with pressure is probably not as critical in the short run as the comfort of the mask and making sure the air is comfortable to breathe. And that's where heated humidification and with heated wall tubing becomes a very essential component. So you bring it out, put it back together, practice with it, you know, and then if you're still having trouble, seek some counsel with your physician or a sleep specialist. And then maybe get it retitrated.
What do you think about, you mentioned this, if your pressure is inordinately high, you just can't tolerate it, do you think that it's acceptable to get it on half as much air pressure? Do you still derive benefit?
Yes. There's no, one thing we've learned of late in some of the data, and sometimes you look at studies other than just looking at obstructive sleep apnea, that we find that usually at 5 or 6 centimeters of water pressure, which is considered starting pressures, that a good bit, I mean 40 to 50% of the apneas are corrected right at that level. Now, if you're at 12 or 15, you know, that's what gets the other half. I mean, the lingering half because of weight, body changes, and sleep stages makes it harder to do that. So a little bit of pressure is better than none at all. But that's on the short run. That's not on the long run.
Why do you have obstruction? Because that's the problem with sleep apnea, the choking. Why do you have that when you're asleep and not when we're sitting here talking? Why am I not obstructing?
Well, when one falls asleep, muscles relax. And muscles in the upper airway are the same way. They will relax. And then the other thing, you're usually lying in bed and gravity then is starting to work against you. And if you have extra weight and tissue in the neck area, it'll push against the airway and it'll occlude or it'll get smaller. And if you go into deep sleep or also what we call rapid eye movement sleep, commonly referred to as dreaming sleep. Your muscles relax even further, so now you have a full closure of the airway, and your brain says, I want to breathe. It starts to arouse you, and you're trying to get that sticky tissue to come apart so you can breathe. And that is the process. And so, you know, it can be the uvula in the back of your throat. It could be your tongue. It could be the sides of your throat below the base of the tongue that all become narrow. It's not a fixed tube. It is a very flexible tube because you swallow and you drink and you breathe and your voice all is operating by the same set of muscles.
You know, I've noticed sometimes people that they sort of sitting at their desk and they start dozing off, and they'll start startle themselves and gasp and sort of exactly like what happens when you have an apneic event during your sleep.
Well, they're dozing off, you're right, and also their head tends to drop.
The bobbleheads.
And when the head drops, the airway further is likely to be compromised.
So getting back to CPAP, we could do a whole show perhaps on getting back to CPAP, talking to people about that you've been prescribed a mask, but you just on a machine, you just don't like to wear it. It's uncomfortable, and I'll put the pitch in for if it didn't work once before, modify something, get a change, and retry it, and don't be afraid to talk to your referring doctor. They see this all the time. They're not gonna throw you out with the bathwater. They want you to get back in. They know that there is a certain percentage of people out there that get prescribed medicine and they don't take it. They get prescribed antibiotics and they don't take the full course. They get prescribed blood pressure pills and unless they're having problems, they don't want to take their pills too. So it's something that you want to help your daytime activities, your waking function, by treating it during your sleep.
Exactly. And the alternatives that we hear about whether it be surgery or whether it be a positional device or whether it be some other surgical thing that they can do for the back of the throat or opening up the nose more are all very useful techniques. However, you know, you have to monitor it like any other treatment. Just like we're saying, the pressure or the mask may not work and it yields that treatment to be not very tolerable. Those other ones aren't magic fixes. If they were, we wouldn't be doing positive airway pressure. We have yet to find anything that's superior to that. Many physicians yearn for an alternative, but you know, when Dr. Colin Sullivan in Sydney, Australia, came up with this idea back in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, it was revolutionary to consider this. But it's still, this many years later, is by far our best treatment. Unfortunately, there's been some biases and some discomforts that we've talked about that's led to some of it, people not using as much as we think they ought to.
We went through the whole course of surgical treatments where they would go in and carve up the back of your throat and slice out the little bell-shaped uvula, the soft palate behind the throat, and only to learn that really wasn't the cure-all that they had hoped.
Correct, and it wasn't lifelong.
No, we see a lot of people that come back that have had the surgery 2 years later that they're getting back on positive airway pressure.
And it's a lot harder to do as good of a job with positive airway pressure when you don't have a uvula.
Well, you know, that space in the back of your throat, it separate. There's a reason you're separating the nose and the mouth, and it occurs when you're eating food. You don't want your mashed potatoes coming out your nose. No. That's a real problem. So we were talking earlier about in-lab polysomnograms and at-home home sleep testing, PSGs and HSTs, what we refer to them as. And so say you're somebody that wants this test, and you go to your doctor and he says, yes, I'm going to send you down to the medical center and I'm going to get you a test in a month and we'll get you all worked up and worked out. And you say, I've heard about a home sleep test. And how do they broach their doctor to discuss this, to get a home sleep test as opposed to an in-lab test?
I think you're going to have to be fairly assertive at saying that you would prefer to start there. Sometimes if you're relatively averse, if you will, to going into a facility to sleep, that it may be a real option for you to take a home sleep test. I think if you are motivated to make it work, it will work. I've utilized them throughout my career and been successful with them. But they also can be a problem in that the sensors will fall off or the person doesn't get it set up right. And they have all the good intentions to doing it as they were instructed, but they failed to succeed. And you got to repeat it. So it can take multiple times. And then the answer that you get from the test can be not quite as conclusive as a sleep study. The reason is that in facility or in lab sleep study, you're assessing up to 22 different parameters, as we say. We have, you know, lots of things we're looking at, a lot of redundancy. In a home sleep test, you have four, maybe. And if any one of those falls off or becomes unable to collect the information, you're really dealing with little or no information to make your diagnosis, and so it is inconclusive, and you need to go into the lab if the signs and symptoms continue to be prevalent.
You're listening to the CPAP show here on AM 1560. We'll be back after this break. CPAP Sleep Specialist Show. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Speer, boarded by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and we're talking about sleep disorders, obstructive sleep apnea, people who refuse to wear their CPAP device at nighttime. And Dr. Speer, we were just mentioning about a new term that I haven't associated with sleep disorders yet, and that's embarrassment. And the embarrassment that people have because they got a sleep disorder. They were tested. Their doctor told them they had a problem. They got the machine. They went home and they set it there by the bedside and they looked at it and they went to put it on and they couldn't remember how to do it.
Right, right. And then when they did put it on, it leaked like a sieve and blew
hurt,
out.
Hurt the nose, hurt the eye.
And they couldn't turn the volume down on the on the pressure, as they say. And it was just a disaster, or the humidifier filled up too high, and it came down the hose and went up their nose, and it was just one calamity after another. And as we were saying, it's not commonsensical, the whole process, to wear something on your nose at night, you know. But if you thought of a jet pilot that needed oxygen above 10,000 feet, everybody puts on a would think, yeah, that's fine. But it's a conscious choice, and when you're doing it on an unconscious level, when you're sleeping, it you know, you worry about certain things, and sometimes you have to look at what you worry about. That a lot of people tell me that I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to breathe with this thing on, and so
I'll die in the night with a mask on my face.
Right, and the point is that that's the least likely thing you're going to do. It'll happen more likely if you don't wear one. But the point is that we cannot oftentimes figure it out how to get the straps right, you know, how to set the humidifier, if there's a ramp or a way to lower the pressure, whatever thing. You know, we got the instructions and we have the booklet in the bag, but, you know, we just choose not to do certain things. And who do you ask? And, you know, you don't want to be handled as though you have no ability to solve a problem, so you don't ask.
Well, hopefully that's the company that I work for, Monitor Medical. You know, that's what they're there for. That's what the people are in the office to re-demonstrate, and nobody's embarrassed there, because that's what we do. And you're right, people will come in and say, I hate to ask you this because I know you showed me how to use this mask, but that's what they're there for. You know, you buy a complex piece of electronic gear and you take it home and you go through the manual and you can't figure out how to plug the TV in, or like my TV, it doesn't have any buttons anywhere. I'm still amazed at how the thing turns on because there's no apparent buttons on it. It's all touch screen, sort of like an iPhone TV.
Right, right. And we're getting more and more of that. There's certain I'm not sure that all the knobs and lights and screens on our CPAP machine help us. Some engineer somewhere made the decision that they could do these things, and the sequence of events on pushing buttons and two buttons and then the third button can leave a lot of people guessing what to do next. And in most of the machines, there's nothing you can do that you can change it that they will allow us to change it once we get it home that we were going to hurt ourselves. So, you know, I always think people need to grab a hold of it, you know, take the humidifier out, crank the humidifier temperature up, crank it down, hit the buttons, and learn the features, because there's a lot of features that nobody uses. And those features can improve one's, you know, acceptance and benefit. So, you know, work with your machine and then ask the questions. And like Monitor Medical, there's no question we've looked at some of the experiences in your company that, in fact, people do much better when you do have people to call and ask.
And we like, if the patient will allow it, to come back and visit them in 2 weeks, 7, 10 days, 14 days after they've taken the machine home, because, as you say, we want to break the bad habits of disassembling the product, leaving pieces off, because these things don't work really well. Imagine today's technology and today's high-end engines on automobiles, and if you just happen to leave a little piece of electronic gear off the car, it really doesn't work quite as well.
That's true. And I mean, if you leave just a piece off of the mask, it is completely dysfunctional.
Do you have a favorite type of mask? Without throwing down too many brand names, do you have type of mask that works for you?
My experience over the years has been that the nasal mask, the smaller profile nasal mask, is over the cup over the nose, tends to be the one that wins out over the long haul. On the short haul, when I mean the short haul, initially, many, many more people, especially in the last few years, have gone with the pillows. And the pillows that go in the nostrils, the key difference that I've found, and this is, again, evolution of technology, is that the nasal cushions, as we call them, with sufficient humidification, have become the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And the nasal mask, I think, may very well not be as prevalent as the number one mask.
And I know that years ago when I started in this business, I didn't put anybody in a full face mask. I was very full face mask averse. I was afraid of it. I too was unsure of how people were going to respond to waking up with something covering their nose and their mouth. But that just hasn't been the case, and people seem to have done really well with a device that, as you said, you know, once you get it on and you lay down, you kind of forget it's there.
Right. And if you do have some tendency to have mouth leaks, you know, pressurizing the mouth with a full face mask, we say, is really relieved that concern or that lack of adequate pressure. We must also say technology, the new full face masks are so much more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Do so much better job at sealing than they did just 5 years ago.
All right, here I'm going to put you on the line. What is your most disgusting mask story? Do you have one about the grossest mask that was ever brought into you?
Well, yeah, I have one. I have two that come to mind. Back in the day when we had a very hard plastic, he decided that he didn't like the way the headgear attached, so he put brass hinges. And then the brass hinges, because of the humidity and the began to rust, or not rust but corrode.
Mm-hmm.
and the mask headgear that he had made was also turning green, and it was just disgusting, but he liked it. But he had worn it for 2 years that way.
I think my grossest story was the one where the patient brought it in and he said, my wife sent me in to get a new mask, and I said, okay. And he goes, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but she says it smells. And he took it out of the bag, and it was so rank, It smelled worse than any gym bag, any pair of tennis shoes that you'd ever smell. Not only did I hand the trash can to him so that he could drop it in the wastebasket, we immediately took it out to the dumpster because it smelled. Because your face has dead skin on it, and it grows bacteria, and it lays down. It's like wearing a shirt. It's pretty gross. So don't let that happen to you. If you've got a CPAP mask, clean it, wash it, get it changed out. Well, you've listened to the current version of the CPAP Sleep Specialist Show. Our guest today has been Dr. Thomas Spear. Thank you, Dr. Spear.
Thank you for having me.
And come back next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock Central Time and wake up America to this CPAP Sleep Specialist Show.